You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome back to another special edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute, in which we're bringing you full audio from some of the best talks from our meeting in Tuscany in July. I'm Zia Morali, and today we have a real head spinner, courtesy of Adam Brown, a physicist at Stanford University, who is looking at ways to relate quantum mechanics to agency. In the past, some physicists and philosophers have turned to quantum theory with its inherent unpredictability and argued that it could be the source of human free will. Brown, however, argues against this, saying that quantum mechanics actually makes the behaviour of agents more predictable, not less. So much so, in fact, Brown is about to talk us through a highly speculative, theoretical way in which you could use a quantum experimental setup to predict what someone will do. Physicists have argued in the past that this is practically impossible. Even if human decision-making is governed by purely predictable deterministic processes, you still wouldn't be able to come up with a machine that can simulate what a real-life person would do without creating such a complex and accurate simulated copy of the person that you'd end up creating a new conscious being in its own right. Brown's response to this involves the use of an interferometer. Now, the talk that you're about to hear gets quite technical, and during his presentation, he often refers to images and animations to help explain the apparatus he is talking about, which of course you can't see on the podcast. So, as a warning, this argument will hinge heavily on an experiment called the Elitzer-Waidman bomb test, in which you're given a package that may contain a live bomb or a dud, and you're asked to work out which you have. The trouble is, if you interfere with the bomb in any way, even so much as firing a particle of light or a photon at it to look at it, it will explode. The bomb test described in the talk uses an interferometer setup to help you determine if you have a live bomb or a dud without firing a photon at it and accidentally exploding the bomb. If you're familiar with this quantum bomb test already, then you're all set to sit back and enjoy the talk. But if, like most of us, you're not already an expert on interferometers, and also perhaps not someone with an excellent visual imagination for recreating complicated experimental setups in their head by listening to people talking about them, then I'm going to recommend that you go to our website fqxi.org/community. If you want to follow all the technical ins and outs on the talk, then that's where you'll find an excellent blog post written by our reporter George Musser that includes Brown's diagrams and animations and has a step-by-step guide through the physics that Brown is about to talk about here. Of course, you may not be so interested in the technical details, and in that case, just take Brown's word for it that the setup works and enjoy the mind-blowing philosophical questions that Brown addresses throughout. The traditional setup allows you to detect a bomb without ever firing a photon at it. Could a similar experiment be used to predict what a person would do without having to simulate their consciousness? Could it help you run experiments that test whether your life decisions will have good or bad outcomes? Could it even be useful if you happen to be God, pondering how to create a universe containing net good?
So today I'm going to be trying to convince you that that quantum mechanics has something to say about agency. I am well aware that I am not the first person to make that claim, so I want to distinguish what I'm going to be saying from what other people have said. There are famous claims, for example, that conscious agents collapse the wave function. That is not going to be my claim. In fact, if that is true, what I'm going to say today is going to be irrelevant. I'm going to assume that's false. There are also claims that consciousness results from quantum mechanical processes in the brain. I'm going to remain completely agnostic on that question. And there's also a claim from Eddington, and I've actually got the quote here. With the advent of the quantum theory, physics is no longer pledged to a scheme of deterministic law, and so science thereby withdraws its moral opposition to free will. I'm going to argue, well, first of all, I think history has not been kind to that claim, both on the physics grounds that the evolution of the wave function is deterministic, and on the philosophy grounds that being instructed what to do by a random number generator doesn't really count as agency. And indeed, my talk today is going to be arguing that this has it backwards, that in some sense, quantum mechanics makes the behavior of agents not less predictable, but more predictable. And I'm going to start off with the same somewhat cowardly caveat that Sean started his talk with, which is that this is a work in progress. And I'm also going to add to it that this is somewhere at the intersection of quantum information theory and philosophy, and I am not really a quantum information theorist, and I'm really not a philosopher. But what I am is amongst friends, so I hope you will take this in that spirit. And I'm going to start off, in fact, on somewhat solid ground with physics. If you are not a physicist and you've not seen anything before, then even if you don't believe anything else I say in this talk, I hope you'll find the first part of the talk fun. So let's start with the sort of classic physics, quantum mechanics object, which is an interferometer. And the way they work is you send a laser beam in, it bounces off two mirrors, and they coherently interfere with each other so that all the light exits the final beam slitter to the right, none of it up. And that is true despite the fact that if you shoved an absorber in the way on any one of the arms, there would be no interference, and some of the light would exit up while the rest of it exited rightwards. And that's true for either path, but somehow when you add them together, you get complete destructive interference upwards, complete constructive interference rightwards, and all the light exits right. If you think that is a weird quantum phenomenon, you are wrong. This is a classical phenomenon. It's just a wave phenomenon. You can do it with water waves. When it becomes a weird quantum phenomenon is when you have both waves and particles, when you attenuate your laser so that there's only one photon going through the apparatus at any given time. And the weird quantum phenomenon is that even though there's only one particle going through the apparatus at any given time, one photon, you still get the interference pattern. However, you can kill the interference pattern by measuring which arm the photon took. So for example, you could have put a mirrored detector on the bottom right. And now let's just be super pedantic about what happens next. There are four possibilities. When you measure which arm it goes down, you can either find that the detector says it went down the bottom arm or on the bottom it didn't go down the bottom arm. And since you've destroyed the interference pattern, it can appear either up or rightwards at the end. It exits the up port or the right port. In particular, even though if you measure the particle, you can find that it didn't. The detector cannot measure it to have gone down the right arm, and yet the photon can still exit upwards because you've destroyed the interference pattern. This is a somewhat strange phenomena, and Elitzer and Weidmann found a particularly vivid way, a way to make it, the sort of strangeness of it, particularly visceral, with a rather nice example. And the nice example is they imagine the following task. You are given a pile of hypersensitive bombs, or maybe duds. You're not really sure. They look the same, the bombs and duds. And the only difference between a bomb and a dud is what they do when a single photon impinges on them. A dud just reflects the photon. Nothing weird happens. But a bomb, true to its name, explodes. So that's the rule. And your job is, from this pile of hypersensitive bombs and or duds, you're required to give me a bomb, something that's definitely certified to be a bomb, a live bomb. If I asked you for a certified dud, that would be an easy thing. You just fire the photon off one of your candidates, and if it explodes, well, too bad, try again. And if it doesn't explode, then you have a certified dud that's definitely a dud. What if I ask you for a certified bomb? Well, the problem is pretty obvious. Once you fire a photon off the candidate, if it doesn't explode, well, no good, that's a dud. And if it does explode, then it was indeed a bomb, but you have not produced a live certified bomb, you've atomized a live certified bomb, and that is against the rules. So I think you will agree that classically this is an impossible task. And now where our pedantry from the last consideration of the interferometer is going to come in, is that it is not a quantum mechanically impossible task. In fact, this is what you want to do. And I think it's pretty clear, given what I said before, why this is what you want to do. So first of all, let's imagine that the candidate is in fact a dud. In which case, you're just going to get exactly the same story as you had before. The dud doesn't in any way detect the photon. The photon just bounces off, and you get complete constructive interference at the right port, complete destructive interference at the top port. The photon never exits upwards. Okay, what about if it's a bomb? Okay, well, now we have a slightly more complicated situation. There are four possibilities. The bomb, by exploding or not exploding, measures which path the photon took through the interferometer. If it finds that it took the bottom path through the interferometer, well, bang, you've just exploded your bomb. No good. But 50% of the time, the photon will take the top path through the interferometer. 25% of the time, it'll emerge from the right port, there being no interference, and 25% of the time, it'll emerge from the top port. Now, the bottom right one is the really interesting case. Here, there has been no explosion, and yet the bomb has emerged, the photon has emerged from the top port. I will just remind you that in the dud case, the photon always emerges from the right port. So what do we infer from the fact that that even though there was no explosion, the photon exits from the up port? What we infer is that we in fact had a bomb. We have successfully completed the Elitzer-Weidman task. We have produced a certified light bomb using the power of quantum mechanics. Okay, this is great. One slightly unsatisfactory element is that it's wasteful. You produce two explosions for every certified live bomb you create. You can actually do better using the quantum Zeno effect. Famously, if you have two filters and they are at 90 degrees to each other, the probability they transmit is cos squared of the angle between them. So if one starts vertical, the other starts horizontal, there is no transmission. Weirdly, if you shove in a filter in the middle that you might imagine could only decrease the absorption, you know, absorb things, could only decrease the transmission rate, the transmission rate then goes up. Just as weird that by putting an absorber in the middle, you increase the transmission rate as the fact, and it is the same fact, that you sometimes get photons emitted upwards even by adding an absorber into your interferometer. And in fact, the more filters you add, the higher the transmission rate. The reason is that the probability of being absorbed is proportional not to delta theta, but to delta theta squared. That is probably the central weirdness of quantum mechanics, is that the absorption rate is not proportional to delta theta, it's proportional to delta theta squared. That's what gives rise to Bell's theorem and all these other weird and wonderful facts. And in particular, that means that if you have n absorbers, the angle required between them goes like 1 over n. So you end up having a probability 1 over n squared of absorbing n times. 1 over n squared times n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. The transmission rate goes to infinity, known as the quantum Zeno effect, or in other contexts as the adiabatic theorem. Okay, so you can combine these two ideas, which in this context means going from there to there, and you can, in fact, have the quantum. Have a perfectly efficient, or approaching perfectly efficient, as this tower of interferometers gets infinitely large. You can have a perfectly efficient bomb detector that never blows up bombs, but nevertheless produces certified bombs. So that's a bomb. Pretty soon after these ideas were developed, people started hunting around for other things other than explosives you could put in the right-hand corner. And one of the most interesting proposals by Mitchison and Joza is that you could put a computer. And I should warn you that from now on in the talk, we're going to become increasingly untethered from engineering considerations and restricted only by the laws of logic and of physics. For a start, this can't really be a Dell computer. This needs to be a quantum computer. It basically works exactly the same principle as the Leiden bomb. It either runs or doesn't run according to where the photon goes. Okay, so what's the computer doing? It's implementing some unitary, and the question you're going to answer is, does that unitary transformation output on the state phi an answer 0 or an answer 1? And then we can just do exactly the same thing as we did with the Weidman bomb, this time in equations for people who like equations. And what you see is that when it outputs the answer zero, you get complete constructive interference. The computation might as well not have happened. It's like a dud, and you get everything emergent from the right. But sometimes, one of the four possibilities when the answer is one is that the computation didn't happen. You took the top path, and yet you learn that the answer you would have got had you done the computation is one without ever doing the computation. It's exactly analogous to the way the Weidman bomb worked. So you can do a counterfactual computation. You can, in some sense, learn the result of the computation without ever doing the computation. And again, we're going to do a sort of Zeno version of this to make it perfectly efficient. Now, this is sort of great little literature on what's called counterfactual computation that ends with the sort of discoverers in this sort of review paper sort of complaining that it's not really good for anything. The reason being is that there had initially been hopes that you could maybe use this to not actually have to build a quantum computer, or maybe it could run faster. But anyway, none of those things are true. It doesn't help you with decoherence. You still need to build the quantum computer. It still needs to work. It's otherwise, it's not going to do its job in the interferometer. It still needs to be protected from decoherence. Basically, the review article ends with the question, who cares? And the point of this talk is that there is, in fact, a reason you should care about whether the computation happened or not. And that's if what the computation is doing is simulating your thought process. You care. So the rest of the talk is going to be considering this possibility that what the quantum computer is doing is simulating you. Two quick assumptions I'm going to make. First of all, if the Copenhagen interpretation is right, this doesn't make any sense. I'm putting a conscious observer in a superposition that will immediately collapse, so I'm going to have to take a no-collapse interpretation of quantum mechanics. The other assumption I'm going to have to make is that the amount of consciousness, the quantity of consciousness, if you simulate a conscious observer in superposition, is given by just Born's rule, basically. It's given by the amplitude squared. Actually, everything I'm going to say goes through if you come up with some reason why it's less than the amplitude squared, but it's just not going to be more than the amplitude squared. Okay, and then, in fact, I'm going to do exactly the same as with the quantum Zeno. This is going to be the setup that I'm going to imagine. Okay, so now we're getting onto philosophy. What is this good for? What does this actually tell us about agency? And since we're now into the philosophy part, I'm going to sort of quote some other FQXI members just so that if we go down, we all go down together. I think that there is a position I've often found pretty compelling is a sort of classical notion of compatibilism, where you say that even deterministic agents are unpredictable. And this really has two components. The first is the claim that to accurately simulate an agent requires simulating their thought process accurately. Seth Lloyd would talk about Hartmann-Stearns theorem, the time hierarchy theorem, that says that in general it's impossible to predict what a conscious agent will do with a procedure that is less sophisticated than simulating the conscious agent. Scott Aronson said the problem of predicting your behavior is you complete, which is, I think, a pretty Scott complete way of stating it. Okay, that's step one. You've got to do a high fidelity simulation of an agent in order to predict what they're going to do. Step two is that a sufficiently high fidelity simulation of an agent would be just as conscious as the original. Radford Neil said the simulation the predictor conducts in order to predict your choice will, if you accept a functionalist view of consciousness, which I suppose I do, create another conscious being, and you have no way of knowing that you are not this being. So this provides quite a nice sort of picture of agency and how we can come to believe that we have agency even in a deterministic world. Because if you want to predict what somebody is going to do and therefore rob them of your agency, you have no option but to create a new agent and imbue it with agency who lives in the computer you're using to simulate them. That's the classical story. It seems like quantum mechanically, it's no longer so obvious that you can make that phenomenon. In particular, it at least appears as though using counterfactual quantum computation, perhaps I should say using counterfactual cognition, you can simulate what somebody's going to do, you can predict what they're going to do without simulating them. And now I'm going to tell you that that is exactly half true. I proved a theorem. Other people have their theorems. I have mine, and this is the theorem. Counterfactual computation can tell you what the answer is. On one branch, you can set it up so that it can tell you what the answer is if the answer is zero without having to run the computation. So long as, if the answer is one, you have to compute them many times. You have to compute that branch many times. In fact, there's a multiplicative inequality. You can set up a counterfactual computation so that n0 is as small as you like, but only at the cost of making n1 very large. So n0 being the number of times you simulate the thought process, weighted by Born's rule, in order to arrive if the answer is zero, so long as n1, the number of weighted computations you have to do in order to arrive at the answer, if the answer is one, is very large. And so that means you can only predict without simulation half the time. If the answer is yes, let us say, you can predict without simulation. If the answer is no, you have to simulate them many times. But for some applications, that's exactly what we want. And let me provide a somewhat fanciful sci-fi scenario here. Leading a happy life is not easy. Some apparently good decisions lead to great sorrow. Sometimes superficially bad decisions lead to great life's satisfaction and meaning. It does not seem unreasonable to believe that to truly know what decisions to make, there is no method that is less complicated than simply making those decisions, leading one's life, and seeing what happens. That, however, algorithm has a problem, which is that if your decision turns out to be very bad, then by the time you get to the end of your life, you have already suffered all the sorrow that derives from your decision. However, there is a solution, and the solution is to counterfactually compute the outcome of your decisions. And as I said, there's an inequality, but you can set up the counterfactual computation in such a way that if the outcome of your life decisions is happiness, you compute it many, many times over. And if the outcome of your life decision is sadness, then the weighted number of computations you perform tends to zero, which seems to be what we're after. And there is the, just for people who like circuit diagrams, that's the circuit that performs that for you. Or if you'll notice a structural similarity between this example and the previous example, now scaled up in our ambitions. You plan to create an entire universe, and you plan to create only those universes that are not only those universes that are perfectly good, but also all universes that are better to exist than not to exist, in the words of FQXI member Don Page. And the question is, how do you know that the universe you're going to make is net positive? Even if you're omnipotent, how do you achieve functional omniscience about the consequences of your actions? And it seems like you basically can't, given some time hierarchy theorems. You just can't do it, classically, because in order to simulate, to know whether a universe is net positive, as more good than evil, you are going to have to simulate those universes and see how it goes. But of course you can do it using counterfactual cognition if the meta laws of the universe you're using to simulate this in are quantum mechanical. So there's just some brief applications of counterfactual cognition. Let me end with two physics points. First of all, notice quite how strong a ability this is that quantum mechanics provides you with. You can essentially impose any boundary conditions you like at the end of the universe. This is not, often we post-select on some quantum, on some final boundary conditions, but what we mean when we post-select is we do our quantum experiment, we measure it at the end, and if we don't like the answer, we just throw it away and run the system again. That is not what we're doing here. What we're doing here is ensuring that if you weren't going to get the answer you didn't like, then in a wave function weighted Born sense, you never instantiated that possibility to begin with. You only simulate those branches that lead to the desired outcome, except with measure zero. The second point is that, sort of inspired by this analysis, you can, in fact, sort of redo, there's a whole field of quantum query complexity, you might be inspired to redo quantum query complexity with now a different counting of the number of queries. Usually you count, in quantum query complexity, you just sort of count the components in the circuit. Sort of, for example, in Grover's algorithm, you'd find that there were root n oracle calls required to determine the answer to a certain question. And just every time you come across in your quantum circuit a certain component, that counts as one query. That is not the right algorithm here. That is not the right counting here. The right counting here is instead of counting each component once, you count each component, if it is a controlled query call, you count each component by the square of the amplitude with which it's called. And so you can just ask a pure physics question, which is how does that affect the counting in quantum query complexity? For example, how does that affect the root n scaling in Grover's algorithm? And the answer may surprise you. That's it.
That was Adam Brown of Stanford University speaking at the 6th International FQXI meeting in Tuscany in July. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, I'm linking to a detailed blog post that I mentioned earlier with handy diagrams and animations that should fill in some of the technical gaps, written by the brilliant physics writer George Musser. We're also linking to a fun thriller created by FQXI member Tagomir Kashlikovsky, which won our video contest a few years ago, bringing to life the Elitzer-Vaidman bomb test that Brown referred to. That's it for now. We'll be posting the video of Brown's talk with slides on the website soon. In the meantime, we have videos, audio, slides, and analysis on the blog from many of the talks from the meeting going up each day. So please do keep checking back. We'll also keep you posted on updates on Twitter at FQXI and on Facebook at FQXI Physics. And you can always reach us by email on podcast@fqxi.org. Thank you for listening. I've been Zia Morali.